much in your career. I left Cavell to finish his pappy's coffee and begin to shape his story. Apparently, that's what he did. It appeared in the morning edition of the Post. Nana Mama is the first one up at our house every day. Whether I wake up at 7 or 6 or 5, I always come down to the kitchen to find a light blazing and Nana already eating breakfast or firing it up over her stove. Nana sat at the kitchen table on that morning in March. She was reading the Washington Post. The headline of the Washington Post read, Sinigi/Murphy, to be hypnotized. Attached to the story, I could see photographs of both Sinigi/Murphy and me. I'd heard the news late the night before. I had called Lee Cavell to give him his exclusive because of our deal. I climbed out of my car at the prison. Reporters from newspapers and TV stations were loitering everywhere outside Lorton. They were waiting for me. So was Sinigi/Murphy. He had been moved to a regular cell in the prison. Once I was inside Gary's prison cell, the process was simple and straightforward. I suggested that he relax and close his eyes. Next, I asked Gary to breathe in, then out, very evenly and slowly. I told him to try to clear his mind of every thought. Finally, to count down slowly from 100. He appeared to be a good subject for hypnosis. He didn't resist, and he slipped deeply into a suggestible state. As far as I could tell, he was under. I proceeded as if he were anyway. I watched him for signs to the contrary, but I saw none. His breathing had slowed noticeably. In the beginning of the session, he was more relaxed than I had seen him before. We chatted about casual, non-threatening subjects for the first few moments. Since he had actually come to, or become himself in the parking lot of the McDonald's, I asked Gary about that once he was fully relaxed. "Do you remember being arrested at a McDonald's in Wilkinsburg?" There was a brief pause, then he said,
"Oh, yes, of course I do."
"I'm glad you remember, because I have a couple of questions about the circumstances at McDonald's. I'm a little unclear about the sequence of events. Do you remember anything you might have eaten inside the restaurant?" I could see his eyes rolling behind the closed lids. He was thinking about it before answering.
"No. No, can't say that I do. I'm not sure if I ate or not."
"Did you notice any people at the McDonald's? Do you remember any customers? A counter girl you might have spoken to?"
It was crowded. No one in particular comes to mind. I recall thinking that some people dress so badly it's comical."
In his mind, he was still inside the McDonald's. He'd come that far with me. "Did you use the restroom?" I already knew that he'd gone to the bathroom. Most of his actions were covered in the reports of the arrest.
"Yes, I used the restroom."
"How about a beverage? Something to drink?" "Bring me along with you. Put yourself right there as much as you can." He smiled.
"Please, don't condescend."
He had cocked his head a little oddly. Then Gary started to laugh, a peculiar laugh, deeper than usual. Strange, though not completely alarming. His voice patterns were becoming more rapid and very clipped.
"You're not smart enough to do this."
I was a little surprised by the change in his tone of voice. "To do what?" "Tell me what you're saying, Gary. I don't follow you."
"To try and trick him, that's what I'm saying. You're bright, but not that bright."
"Who am I trying to trick?"
"Sinigi, of course. He's right there in the McDonald's. He's pretending to get coffee, but he's really pissed off. He's about to go nuclear. He needs attention now."
"Why is he angry? Do you know why?"
"He's pissed because they got lucky. That's why."
"Who got lucky?"
"The police. He's pissed because stupid people could luck out and ruin everything, screw up the master plan."
"I'd like to talk to him about it," I said. I was trying to stay as matter-of-fact as he was. "If Sinigi were here now, maybe we could talk."
"No. No, you're not on a level with him. You wouldn't understand anything he has to say. You don't have a clue about Sinigi."
"Is he still angry? Is he angry now? Being here in prison? What does Sinigi think about being in this cell?"
"He says, fuck you. Fuck you."
He lunged at me. He grabbed my shirt and tie, the front of my sport jacket. He was physically strong, but so am I. I let him hold, and I held on to him. We were in a powerful bear hug. Our heads came together and cracked. I could have broken free, but I didn't try. He wasn't really hurting me. It was more as if he were issuing a threat, drawing a line between us. Campbell and his guards came rushing down the corridor. Suniji/Murphy let go of me and began throwing himself at the cell door. Spit ran from the side of his mouth. He began screaming, cursing at the top of his voice. The guards wrestled him onto the floor. They restrained him with difficulty. Suniji was much more powerful than his slender body would have suggested. The RN followed him in and gave him a shot of Ativan. Within minutes, he was asleep on the floor of the cell. The guards lifted him onto his cot and wrapped him in a restraining jacket. I waited until they locked him in the cell. Who was in the cell? Gary Suniji? Gary Murphy? Or both of them? That night, Chief Pittman called me at home. I didn't think he wanted to congratulate me on my work with Suniji/Murphy. I was right. The jefe did ask me to stop by his office the next morning. "What's up?" I asked him. He wouldn't tell me over the phone. In the morning, I made sure I was clean-shaven, and I put on my leather car coat for the occasion. When I arrived at Pittman's office, there was too much activity for 7:45 in the morning. Even the jefe's assistant seemed fully employed for a change. Old Fred Cook is a failed vice detective, now posing as an assistant. He looks like one of the artifacts they dig up for old-timer baseball games. "Chief's ready for you." He served up one of his thin-lipped smiles. I went inside expecting the worst, but I underestimated the chief of detectives a little. Mayor Carl Monroe was in the office with Pittman. So was our police captain, Christopher Clouser, and, of all people, John Sampson. It appeared that one of Washington's ever-so-popular morning events, a working breakfast, had been set up in the chief's inner sanctum. "It's not all bad," Sampson said in a low voice. "It's not bad at all." Carl Monroe smiled jovially when he saw the chiseled look on my face. "We have some good news for both of you. Very good news. Shall I?" "Yeah, I think so. You and Samson are being promoted today. Congratulations to our newest senior detective and our newest divisional chief." They clapped approvingly. Samson and I exchanged quizzical looks. "Maybe you'd like to tell Samson and me what's going on here?" I smiled conspiratorially at Monroe. "You know, the subtext?" Carl Monroe had his magnificent smile blazing away. "I was asked to come here because you and Detective Sampson were being promoted. That's about it. I was very happy to come, Alex, at 7:45 this morning." "There are a couple of other things to discuss," Pittman said, but then waved off the idea of any real substance entering the ceremonial conversation. "They can wait until after. There's coffee and sweet cakes first." "I think we ought to discuss everything now," I said. I shifted my eyes to Monroe. "Put it out on the table with the sweet cakes." Chief Pittman poured coffee into an expensive china cup that was too small and delicate for his hand. "We're bumping into the FBI, Justice, the Secret Service on this kidnapping case. It's no good for anybody. We've decided to pull back completely, to take you off the case again." Bingo. The other shoe had dropped. The truth was out at our little working breakfast. All of a sudden, everybody in the office was talking at once. "This is total bullshit," Sampson told the mayor to his face, "and you know it." "I've begun sessions with Suniji/Murphy," I said to Pittman and Monroe and Captain Clouser. "I hypnotized him yesterday." "Jesus fucking Christ, no, don't do this, not now." "We're aware of your progress with Gary Suniji. We had to make a decision, and we've made it." "You want the truth, Alex?" Carl Monroe's voice suddenly rang out in the room. "You want to hear the truth about this?" I looked at him. "Always." Monroe stared right into my eyes. "A great deal of pressure has been used by the Attorney General on a lot of people in Washington. A huge trial will begin, I believe, within 6 weeks at the most. The Orient Express has already left the station, Alex. You're not on it. I'm not on it. Suniji/Murphy is on it." "The prosecutor, the Justice Department has decided to stop your sessions with Suniji/Murphy. A team of psychiatrists has been formally assigned to him. That's the way it will work from here on. This case has moved into a new phase, and our involvement won't be needed." Sampson and I walked out of our own party. Our involvement was no longer needed. In late September, Jesse Flanagan and I went away to the Virgin Islands. We escaped for a long weekend, just the two of us. It was Jesse's idea. I thought it was a good one. R&R. We were curious, apprehensive, excited about 4 uninterrupted days together. We took scuba and snorkeling lessons. We rode horses along a beach that ran uninterrupted for over 3 miles. We drove a Range Rover up into the jungle and got lost for a half day. The most unforgettable experience was a visit to an unlikely place that we named Jesse and Alex's private island in paradise. It was a spot the hotel found for us. They dropped us off in a boat and left us all alone. "This is the most awe-inspiring place that I've ever been in my life," Jesse said. "Look at all this water and sand, overhanging cliffs, the reef out there." "It's not Fifth Street, but it's okay." I smiled and looked around. Our private island was mostly a long shelf of white sand that felt like sugar under our feet. Beyond the beach was the lushest green jungle we had ever seen. It was dotted with white roses and bougainvillea. The blue-green sea there was as clear as spring water. The kitchen at the inn had packed a lunch. Fine wines, exotic cheeses, lobster, crab meat, and various salads. Not another person was anywhere in sight. We did the natural thing. We took off our clothes. No shame, no taboos. We were alone in paradise, right? Suddenly, and way too quickly, our busman's holiday was over. We found ourselves trapped on board an American Airlines flight back to Washington. Back to dreary, rainy weather, according to reports. At 2:30 on Tuesday afternoon, I got back to Washington at 11 o'clock. I got a call from Sampson. He wanted to meet me at the Sanders house. He thought we made a new connection between the kidnapping and the Project murders. He was pumped as hell with his news. I hadn't been back to the Sanders crime scene in several months, but it was all sadly familiar. The windows were dark from the outside. I wondered if the house would ever be sold or even rented again. I sat in my car in the Sanders driveway and read through the original detective's report. There was nothing in the reports I didn't already know and hadn't gone over a dozen times. I kept staring at the house. Where was Sampson, and what did he want with me here? He pulled up behind me at 3 o'clock sharp. He climbed out of his battered Nissan and joined me in the front seat of the Porsche. "Oh, you are brown sugar now. You look sweet enough to eat." "You're still big and ugly. Nothing changes. What do you have here?" "Police work at its very best," Sampson said. "By the way, you were right to keep after this thing." Outside the car, the wind was howling and heavy with rain. "Are we going inside?" I asked him. "Actually, we're here to visit the next-door neighbors," he said. "Something happened here that I don't understand yet. It's important, though, Alex. I need your head on it." We went to visit the Sanders' next-door neighbors, the Cerisiers. It was important. I already knew that Nina Cerisier had been Suzette Sanders' best friend since they were little girls. The families had been living next door to each other since 1979. Nina, as well as her mother and father, hadn't gotten over the murders. We were invited in by Mrs. Cerisier, who shouted upstairs for her daughter Nina. We were seated around the Cerisier's kitchen table. Nina Cerisier was very cool and distant when she appeared in the kitchen. She was a plain-looking girl, about 15 or 16. I could tell that she didn't want to be there. "Last week," Sampson said for my benefit, "Nina came forward and told a teacher's aide at Southeast that she might have seen the killer a couple of nights before the murders. She'd been afraid to talk about it." "I understand," I said.
"I saw he'd been caught," Nina said in an offhand manner. "I wasn't so scared no more. I'm still some scared, though."
"How did you recognize him?" I asked Nina.
"Saw him on the TV. He did that big kidnapping thing, too," she said. "He all over TV."
"She recognized Gary Murphy," I said to Sampson. That meant she'd seen him without a schoolteacher disguise.
"You sure it was the same man as on TV?" Sampson asked Nina.
"Yes. He watched my girlfriend Suzette's house. I thought it real strange. Not many whites round here."
"Did you see him in the daytime or at night?" I asked the girl.
"Night. But I know it him. Sanders' porch light on bright. Mrs. Sanders afraid of everything. Everybody."
I turned to Sampson. "Puts him at the murder scene." Sampson nodded and looked back at Nina.
"Would you tell Detective Cross what else you saw?"
Another white man with him, Nina Ceresier said. Man wait in his car while the other, he looking at Suzette's house. Other white man here all the time. Two men.
Later that night, I was with Jessie. For over a month, she'd had tickets for a Georgetown basketball game I wanted to see in the worst way. On our ride over there, we did something we rarely do. We talked about nothing but the job. I dropped the latest bomb, the accomplice theory, on her.
I don't understand one beguiling aspect of all of this, Jessie said after she'd listened to me tell Nina Cerisi your story.
Ask the shell answer, man. I understand everything beguiling.
Okay. This girl was friends with Suzette Sanders, right? She was close to the family, and still she didn't talk. Because relations with the police are that bad in the neighborhood? I don't know if I buy it. All of a sudden now, she comes forward?
I buy it, I told Jessie. The Metro Police are like rat poison with lots of folks in these neighborhoods. I live there. They know me, and I'm just barely accepted.
It's still strange to me, Alex. It's just too odd. The girls were supposed to be friends.
The PLO would talk to the Israeli army before some of the people in Southeast would talk to the police.
So what do you think now that you've heard the Ceresier girl and her supposed revelation? What do you make of this accomplice?
It doesn't quite track for me yet, I admitted, which means that it tracks perfectly with everything that's happened so far. I believe the Ceresier girl saw someone. The question is, who?
Well, I have to say it, Alex. This lead sounds like a wild goose chase.
Just before 8, we arrived at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. Georgetown was playing St. John's from New York City. Jessie had choice tickets. That proved she knew everyone in town. It's easier to get into an inauguration ball than certain Big East games. We held hands as we strolled across the parking lot toward the glittery Cap Center. I got to see Gary Murphy again on the 1st of October. New evidence was the stated reason. By that time, half the world had talked to Nina Ceresier. The accomplice theory had a life of its own. We were using SIT to scour the neighborhood around the Ceresier house. I tried everything from mugshot books to identikit drawings with Nina Ceresier. So far, it hadn't helped her find a likeness of the accomplice. We knew it was a male, white, and Nina thought he had a stocky frame. The FBI claimed to be intensifying their search for the pilot in Florida. Dr. Campbell walked me down the maximum security corridor inside Lorton Prison. We arrived at the cell block where Gary Sinigi/Murphy was still being kept. Sinigi/Murphy's cell, the entire corridor, was well lighted, but he squinted up from his cot. It took a moment for him to recognize me. When he finally did, he smiled. He still looked like this nice small-town young man.
Why did you stop coming to see me, Alex? I had nobody I could talk to.
They wouldn't let me see you for a while, I told him. But it's worked out, so here I am. He looked hurt. He was nibbling on his lower lip and staring down at his canvas prison shoes. Suddenly, his face contorted and he laughed loudly. The sound echoed through the small cell. Sinigi/Murphy leaned closer to me.
You know, you're really just another dumb bastard. So fucking easy to manipulate, just like all the others before you. Smart, but not smart enough.
I stared at him, surprised.
The lights are on, but there's nobody home.
He commented on the expression that must have been on my face. No, I'm here, I said. I just underestimated you more than I should have. My mistake.
Caught up with reality, have we?
The terrible smirk remained across his face.
You sure you understand? You sure, Dr. Detective?
Of course I understood. I had just met Gary Sinigi for the very first time. We had just been introduced by Gary Murphy. The process is called rapid cycling. The kidnapper was staring out at me. He was gloating, showing off, being himself for the first time with me.
You okay?
I'm just great. No problem at all, I said.
Really? You don't seem okay to me. Something's wrong, isn't it, Alex?
Now he seemed deeply concerned. Hey, listen. I finally raised my voice. Fuck off, Sinigi. How's that for reality testing?
Wait a minute.
He shook his head back and forth. The wolfish grin had disappeared just as suddenly as it had appeared a moment before.
Why are you calling me Suniji? What is this, Doctor? What's going on?
I watched his face, and I could not believe what I was seeing. He changed again. Snap. Gary Suniji was gone. He changed personas 2, maybe 3 times in a matter of minutes. Gary Murphy? I tested. He nodded.
Who else? Seriously, Doctor, what's the matter? What is going on? You go away for weeks, now you're back.
Tell me what just happened, I said. I continued to stare at him. Just now, tell me what you think just happened. He looked confused, totally baffled by my question. If all of this was an act, it was the most brilliantly awesome and convincing performance I had ever seen in my years as a shrink.
I don't understand. You come here to my cell. You seem a little tense. Maybe you were embarrassed because you haven't been around lately. Then you call me Suniji, completely out of the blue. That's not supposed to be funny, is it?
Was it possible he didn't know what had happened less than 60 seconds ago? Or was this Gary Suniji play-acting with me? Could he be slipping in and out of his fugue state so easily and so seamlessly? It could be, but it was rare. In this case, it could create an unbelievable mockery of a courtroom trial.
When she worked with the others, picking fruits and vegetables on the side of the mountain, Maggie Rose tried to remember how it had been back home. At first, her list, the things she remembered, was basic and very general. Most of all, she missed her mother and father so much. She missed them every minute of every day. She also missed her friends at school, especially Shrimpy, and Nintendo games, and her clothes closet. Having parties after school was so great. So was taking a bath in the 3rd floor room over the gardens. The more she thought about home, though, the more she remembered, the more Maggie Rose improved her memory list. She missed the way she sometimes would get between her mother and father when they hugged or kissed. "We three," she called it. She missed characters her father had enacted for her, mostly when she was little. There was Hank, a big southern drawling father who loved to exclaim, "Who's talking to you?" Her mother would make up songs and sing them to her. Her mother had sung to her ever since she could remember. She sang, "I love you so much, Maggie, there's nothing I wouldn't do for you, nothing in the whole wide world." Maggie would sing, "Will you take me to Disneyland?" Her mom would answer, "I would do that, Maggie Rose." Maggie could remember whole days she had spent in school going from class to class. She remembered Miss Kim's special winks for her. "I'll do anything for you, dear, anything, 'cause you mean everything to me." Maggie could still hear her mom singing the words to her. "Would you please, please come and take me home?" Maggie sang inside her head. "Would you please, please come?" But no one sang anything, not anymore. No one ever sang to Maggie Rose. No one remembered her anymore. Or so she believed in her broken heart.
I met with Suniji / Murphy 6 times over the next 2 weeks. He wouldn't let me get close to him again, though he claimed this wasn't so. Something had changed. I'd lost him. Both of him. On the 15th of October, a federal judge ordered a stay, temporarily halting the commencement of the kidnapping trial. This was to be the final of several delaying tactics by Suniji / Murphy's defense lawyer, Anthony Nathan. Within 1 week, lightning speed for this kind of complex legal maneuvering, Judge Linda Kaplan had denied the defense requests. On the 27th of October, the trial of the state versus Murphy began. At 9:05 that morning, Samson and I headed for a back entrance into the federal building on Indiana Avenue. As best we could, we were traveling incognito. Out front on 3rd Street, a crowd of a couple of thousand surrounded the main courthouse entrance. Another 200 people, including 7 rows of reporters, were already inside. The prosecutor had tried to bar the press, but it had been denied. A handful of reporters were waiting at the back entrance, which is reserved for deliveries, as well as for a few shy judges and lawyers. Most veteran cops who come to the courthouse also choose the back gate. Microphones were immediately pushed at me and Samson.
Detective Cross, is it true that you were cut out of the case by the FBI?
No, I have an okay relationship with the FBI.
Are you still seeing Gary Murphy at Lorton, Detective?
I'm part of a team of doctors who see him. We made it to a service elevator and tried to keep the reporters out of the same car, which wasn't easy.
We have a confirmed rumor that Anthony Nathan is going for a temporary insanity plea. Any comment on that?
None at all. Ask Anthony Nathan. The ancient doors finally shut. The elevator started to rumble up toward the seventh floor. Seventh heaven, as it's known in the trade. The seventh had never been quieter or more under control. The usual train station scene of policemen, young thugs and their families, hardened crooks, lawyers and judges, had been stemmed by an order restricting the floor to the single case. This was the big one. Trial of the century. We arrived just in time to see the prosecutor enter the courtroom. Mary Warner was a diminutive 36-year-old U.S. attorney from the Sixth Circuit. She was supposed to be the courtroom equal of defense lawyer Anthony Nathan. Like Nathan, she had never tasted defeat, at least not in any significant case. Mary Warner had a glowing reputation for tireless preparation and faultless, highly persuasive courtroom demeanor. Carl Monroe was there, too. Mayor Monroe couldn't stay away from the crowds. He saw me but didn't come over, just flashed a patented smile across the broad concourse. If I hadn't known exactly where I stood with him, I did now. My appointment to divisional chief would be my last upgrade. They'd done that to prove I had been a good choice for the hostage rescue team, to validate their decision, and to cover up any possible questions about my conduct in Miami. Leading up to the trial day, the big news around Washington had been that Secretary of the Treasury Goldberg was working on the prosecution case himself, that and Anthony Nathan being the defense attorney. I watched Gary's super lawyer, Anthony Nathan, as he obnoxiously swaggered around the front of the courtroom. He was certainly manic, widely known for infuriating witnesses during cross-examination. Did Gary have the presence of mind to select Nathan? What had drawn the two of them together? In one way, though, it seemed a natural pairing, a borderline madman defending another madman. Anthony Nathan had already publicly proclaimed, "This will be an absolute zoo, a zoo or a Wild West Frontier justice show, I promise you." My pulse was racing as the bailiff finally stood before the assemblage and called the room to order. I saw Jessie across the room. She was dressed like the important person that she is in the service. Pinstriped suit, heels, shiny black attaché case. She saw me and rolled her eyes. On the right side of the courtroom, I saw Catherine Rose and Thomas Dunn. Their presence brought even more of an aura of unreality. Judge Linda Kaplan was known as an eloquent and energetic woman who never let lawyers get the best of her. She had been on the bench for less than 5 years, but had already handled some of the biggest trials in Washington. She was known to rule her courtroom with complete authority. Gary Sinise / Murphy had been quietly, almost surreptitiously, escorted to his place. He was already seated, looking well-behaved as Gary Murphy always did. Several well-known journalists were present, at least a couple of them writing books about the kidnapping. The opposing lawyer teams looked supremely confident and well-prepared on the first day, as though their cases were invincible. The trial began. We were off and running. A parade of medical experts began to testify at the Sinise / Murphy trial. Assistant medical examiners took the stand. Experts came from Walter Reed, from Lorton Prison, from the Army, from the FBI. Photos and 4x6-foot schematic drawings were displayed and over-explained. Crime scene locations were visited and revisited on the eerie charts that dominated the trial's first week. 8 different psychiatrists and psychologists were brought to the stand to build the case that Gary Sinise / Murphy was in control of his actions, that he was a deviant sociopath, that he was rational, cold-blooded, and very sane. That Gary Sinise / Murphy had consciously and deliberately kidnapped 2 children. He had killed one or both of them. He had killed others, at least 5 and possibly more. He was the human monster we all have nightmares about, so said all the prosecution experts. The chief of psychiatry from Walter Reed was on the stand for most of one afternoon. She had interviewed Gary Murphy on a dozen occasions. After a long description of a disturbed childhood in Princeton, New Jersey, and teenage years marked by violent outbursts against both human beings and animals,
Dr. Maria Rocco was asked to give her psychiatric evaluation of Gary Murphy. I see someone who is an extremely dangerous sociopath. I believe Gary Murphy is fully aware of all his actions. I absolutely do not believe he is a multiple personality. So it was that Mary Warner artfully laid out her case every day. She was assembling a terribly complex jigsaw puzzle for the judge and jury. Each day of the trial, she would concentrate on one new puzzle piece. She would show them the piece, she would explain it thoroughly, she would then insert the piece into the puzzle. She accomplished all of this while Anthony Nathan was objecting to virtually every point she attempted to make. Nathan's defense was simple enough, and he never wavered from it. Gary Murphy was innocent because he had committed no crime. Gary Sinigi had. Anthony Nathan paced the front of the courtroom with his usual swagger. I am not a nice person. Anthony Nathan stood before the jury of 7 women and 5 men on the Monday of the second week. At least not in the courtroom. People say that I have a perpetual sneer, that I'm a pompous man, that I'm an insufferable egomaniac. It's all true, Nathan said to his captive audience. And that's what gets me into trouble sometimes. I do tell the truth. I'm obsessed with telling the truth. I have no patience, none at all, with half-truths. And I have never taken a case where I cannot tell the truth. My defense of Gary Murphy is simple. Perhaps the least complex and controversial I've ever delivered to any jury. It is about truth. Ms. Warner and her team understand how strong the defense is. And that's precisely why she has just laid before you more facts than the Warren Commission used to prove exactly the same thing. Absolutely nothing. If you could cross-examine Ms. Warner and she would answer honestly, she would tell you that. Then we could all go home. Some members of the jury were leaning in closer to listen and watch. Each time that Nathan passed by, he got a half-step closer to them. Someone, several someones, asked me why I took this case. I told them, as simply as I'll tell you now, that the evidence makes this a certain winner for the defense. Here's a stunning statement of fact. Ms. Warner did not want to bring this trial to jury at this time. Her boss, the Secretary of the Treasury, forced this case to trial. He forced the trial to take place in record time. Never have the wheels of justice moved so fast. In this particular instance, because of the suffering of Mr. Goldberg and his family, the wheels have moved very fast. And because of Catherine Rose Dunn and her family, who are famous and rich and very powerful, and who also want their suffering to end. Who can blame them for that? I certainly don't. But not at the expense of the life of an innocent man. This man, Gary Murphy, does not deserve to suffer as they have suffered. Nathan now walked over to where Gary sat, blonde, athletic-looking Gary Murphy, who looked like a grown-up Boy Scout. This man is as good a man as you will find anywhere in this courtroom. I'll prove it to you, too. Gary Murphy is a good man. Remember that. There's another fact for you. It is one of two facts, just two, that I want you to remember. The other fact is that Gary Sinigi is insane. I've met Sinigi. You will too. I promise you this. You will all meet Sinigi, and once you have, you will not be able to convict Gary Murphy. You will end up liking Gary Murphy and rooting for him in his personal battle with Sinigi. Gary Murphy cannot be convicted of murders and a kidnapping that were committed by Gary Sinigi. Anthony Nathan then proceeded to call character witness after character witness. Surprisingly, they included staff members at Washington Day, as well as some students. They included neighbors of the Murphys from Delaware. Anthony Nathan fired his first real salvo late in the trial's second week. It was as dramatic as it was unexpected. It started with a side bench conference Nathan and Mary Warner had with Judge Kaplan. During the conference, Mary Warner raised her voice for one of the few times during the trial. Your Honor, I object. I must object to this stunt. This is a stunt. The courtroom was already buzzing. Judge Kaplan had apparently ruled in favor of the defense. Mary Warner returned to her seat, but she had lost some of her composure. Why weren't we informed of this beforehand? She called out. Why wasn't this revealed in pre-trial? Nathan held up his hands and actually quieted the room. He gave everyone the news. I call Dr. Alex Cross as a defense witness. I am calling him as a hostile and uncooperative witness, but a witness for the defense nonetheless. I was the stunt. I'm a homicide detective with the Washington Police Department. My official rank is divisional chief. Sometimes, I get assigned to violent crimes where there are psychological considerations that might mean something to the case. I stated this under oath inside a crowded, hushed, very electric Washington courtroom. It was Monday morning. Can you tell us why you are assigned cases with psychological implications? Anthony Nathan asked me. I'm a psychologist as well as a detective. I had a private practice before I joined the D.C. police force, I said. Your degree is from? As you already know, Mr. Nathan, my doctorate is from Johns Hopkins. One of the finest schools in the country, he said. Objection! That's Mr. Nathan's opinion. Mary Warner made a fair legal point. Judge Kaplan upheld the objection. You've also published articles in psychiatric archives in the American Journal of Psychiatry, Nathan continued. I've written a few papers. It's really not such a big deal, Mr. Nathan. A lot of psychologists publish. But not in the journal and archives, Dr. Cross. What was the subject of these learned articles? I write about the criminal mind. I know enough 3- and 4-syllable words to qualify for the so-called learned journals. I admire your modesty. I honestly do. Tell me something, Dr. Cross. You've observed me these past few weeks. How would you describe my personality? I'd need some private sessions for that, Mr. Nathan. Hazard a guess, Nathan continued. You're neurotic, I smiled, and probably devious. Nathan faced the jury and turned his palms up. At least he's honest, and if nothing else, I get a free shrink session this morning. Laughter came from the jury box. I got the feeling that some of the jurors were beginning to change their minds about Anthony Nathan, and maybe about his client as well. How many sessions have you had with Gary Murphy? He asked me now. We had 15 sessions over a period of 3.5 months. Enough to form some opinions, I trust. Psychiatry isn't that exact a science. I would like to have had more sessions. I do have some preliminary opinions. Which are? Nathan asked me. Objection! Mary Warner rose once again. Detective Cross has just said he would need more sessions to form a final medical opinion. Overruled, Judge Kaplan said. Detective Cross has also stated he has some preliminary opinions. I'd like to hear what those are. Anthony Nathan turned to me. As a police officer involved from the very beginning of this case, and as a trained psychologist, can you give us your professional opinion of Gary Murphy? I looked at Murphy / Sinigi. He appeared to be Gary Murphy. My first feelings and honest impressions were very basic and human. The kidnapping by a teacher shocked and disturbed me, I began my answer. It was a profound breach of trust. It got much worse than that. I personally saw the tortured body of Michael Goldberg. It's something I will never forget. I have talked with Mr. and Mrs. Dunn about their little girl. I feel as if I know Maggie Rose Dunn. I also saw the murder victims at the Turner and Sanders houses. You know better than that. Judge Kaplan froze me with a very cold look. Strike it from the record. The jury is instructed to disregard. There is no proof that the defendant is involved in any way with the events just mentioned. You asked for an honest answer, I said to Nathan. You wanted to hear what I believe. That's what you're getting. Nathan was nodding his head as he walked to the jury box. He turned back toward me. Fair enough. Fair enough. I am sure we'll get absolute honesty from you, Dr. Cross, whether I like that honesty or not. I wanted to catch the kidnapper so badly that it hurt, I said. You actually hated the kidnapper. You wanted to see whoever it was punished to the maximum allowable by law? I did. I still do, I answered Nathan. When Gary Murphy was apprehended, you were there. He was charged with the crime. You then had several sessions with him. What do you believe right now about Gary Murphy? I honestly don't know what to believe right now. Anthony Nathan didn't miss a beat. Then there is reasonable doubt in your mind? Mary Warner stated. Suggestive, leading the witness? The jury will disregard, said Judge Kaplan. Tell us what your feelings are at this moment about Gary Murphy. Give us a professional opinion, Dr. Cross, said Nathan. There's no way yet for me to know if he is Gary Murphy or Gary Sinigi. I'm not sure if two personalities do exist in this man. I believe there is a chance he could be a split personality. And if he were a split personality? If that were true, Gary Murphy could have little or no conscious idea about the actions of Gary Sinigi. He could also be a brilliant sociopath who's manipulating every one of us. You too. Okay, I can accept those perimeters, Nathan said. This concept of doubt seems pivotal, doesn't it? He continued. This is the whole ball game. I would therefore like you to help the jury make their important decision. Dr. Cross, I want you to hypnotize Gary Murphy, he announced. Here, in this courtroom, let the jurors decide for themselves, and I have the fullest confidence in this jury and their decision. I have all the confidence in the world that when these people see all the evidence, they'll arrive at the right decision. Don't you, Dr. Cross? The following morning, two simple red leather armchairs were brought in for the session between Gary and me. To help him get relaxed, the room's overhead lighting was dimmed. Both of us were mic'd. Those were the only extra touches allowed by Judge Kaplan. An alternative to this would have been a videotape of our session, but Gary said he believed he could be hypnotized inside the courtroom. His lawyer wanted him to try. In the past, I'd used a simple verbally suggestive technique with Gary. We began the courtroom hypnosis in that same way. Hypnosis isn't nearly as complex as most people think. Gary, I said, I want you to sit back and try and relax and we'll see what happens.
I'll do the best I can.
I'm going to hypnotize you again because your lawyer feels it may help your case. You've told me that you want that help. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I want to tell the truth. I want to know the truth myself.
All right, then. I'd like you to count backwards from 100. We've done this before. Feel yourself relaxing with each number. You can begin to count. Gary Murphy began to count backwards. Your eyes are starting to close. You feel much more relaxed now, in a sleeping state, breathing deeply. I said in a voice that got quieter and quieter, almost a monotone. The courtroom was very nearly silent. Gary finally stopped counting. Are you comfortable? Is everything okay? I asked him.
Yes, I'm fine. I feel good.
If you want to stop the session for any reason, you know the way back out of this. He nodded softly as he spoke.
I do. I'm okay, though.
At another time in a past session, we talked about your waking up at the McDonald's. You told me that you woke up as if you'd been dreaming. Do you remember that?
That's right. Sure, I remember. I woke up in a police car outside McDonald's. I came to, and the police were there. They were arresting me.
How did you feel when the police arrested you?
I felt like it couldn't be happening. No way. It had to be a bad dream. I told them I was a salesman. I told them where I lived in Delaware. Anything I could think of to show they had the wrong person. Not a criminal. I don't have any record with the police.
We talked about the time just before you were arrested. That day, when you went into the fast food restaurant.
I'm not sure if I can remember. Let me try and think about it.
Gary appeared to be struggling a little. You stopped to go to the bathroom inside the McDonald's restaurant.
I remember. I can see myself at the McDonald's for sure. I remember being there.
Take your time. We have plenty of time, Gary.
Very crowded with people. The restaurant area was crowded, I mean. I went up to the bathroom door. Then I didn't go inside for some reason. I don't know why not. That's funny. I don't remember.
What were you feeling then, when you remained outside the restroom? Do you remember how you felt?
Agitated. Getting worse. I could feel the blood pumping inside my head. I was upset, and I didn't know why.
Sinigi slash Murphy was staring straight ahead. He was looking to the left of where I sat. I was a little surprised at how easy it was for me to forget the courtroom audience that was watching both of us.
Was Suniji there in the restaurant? He tilted his head slightly.
Suniji's in there. Yes, he's in the McDonald's.
He became excited.
Pretending to get coffee. But he looks angry. I think he's really mad.
Why is he mad? Do you know? What is it that gets Suniji angry?
I think it's because things got ruined on him. The police were unbelievably lucky. His plan to be famous got screwed up. Totally messed up. Now he feels like Bruno Richard Hauptmann, just another loser.
This was news. He hadn't talked about the actual kidnapping before. I was oblivious to everything in the courtroom. My eyes stayed on Gary Suniji / Murphy. I tried to sound as casual and non-threatening as I could. What went wrong with Suniji's plan?
Everything that could go wrong.
He was still Gary Murphy. I could see that. He had not transferred into the Suniji personality, but Gary Murphy knew about Gary Suniji's activities. Under hypnosis, Gary Murphy knew Suniji's thoughts. The courtroom remained silent and very still. More details about the kidnapping came from Gary.
He checked on the Goldberg boy, and the boy was dead. His face was all blue. Must have been too much of the barbiturate. Suniji couldn't believe that he'd made a mistake. He'd been so thorough and careful. He talked to anesthesiologists beforehand.
I asked a key question. How did the boy's body get so bruised and beaten? What exactly happened to the Goldberg boy?
Suniji went a little crazy. He couldn't believe his bad luck. He hit the Goldberg boy's body over and over with a heavy shovel.
The way he was talking about Suniji was extremely credible so far. What shovel was that?
The shovel he used to dig them up. They were buried in the barn. They had an air supply for a couple of days. It was like a fallout shelter, you see. The air system worked beautifully. Everything did. Suniji invented it himself. He built it himself.
What about the little girl? What about Maggie Rose?
She was fine. Suniji gave her Valium the second time to put her back to sleep. She was terrified, screaming, because it was so dark under the ground, pitch black. But it wasn't that bad. Suniji had seen worse himself, the basement.
Where is Maggie Rose now? I asked Gary Murphy.
Don't know,
he said without hesitation.
Suniji went back to get her. The FBI had agreed to the 10 million ransom. Everything was all set. But she was gone. Maggie Rose wasn't there when Suniji came back again. She was gone. Somebody else had taken the girl out of there.
The spectators in the courtroom were no longer quiet, but I still kept my concentration on Gary. Did you dig her up, Gary? Did you rescue the little girl from Suniji? Do you know where Maggie Rose is now? I asked him. He didn't like that line of questioning. He was perspiring heavily. His eyelids flickered.
Of course not. No, I had nothing to do with any of it. It was Suniji all the way. I can't control him. Nobody can. Don't you understand that?
I leaned way forward in my chair. Is Suniji here right now? Is he here with us this morning? Under any other circumstances, I wouldn't have tried to push him this far. Can I ask Suniji what happened to Maggie Rose? Gary Murphy shook his head repeatedly from side to side. He knew something else was happening to him now.
It's too scary now. It's scary. Suniji's real bad news. I can't talk about him anymore. I won't. Please, help me, Dr. Cross. Please, help me.
All right, Gary. That's enough. I brought Gary out of hypnosis immediately. Suddenly, Gary Murphy was back in the courtroom with me. His eyes focused on mine. I saw nothing but fear in them. Somebody else had Maggie Rose done. Was that possible? The next morning, I tried to put Suniji / Murphy under hypnosis a second time. The hypnosis didn't work this time. Gary Murphy was too frightened, or so his lawyer claimed. There was too much hubbub in the crowded courtroom. The room was cleared once by Judge Kaplan, but that didn't help either. I was cross-examined by the prosecution that day, but Mary Warner was more interested in getting me off the stand than in questioning my credentials. My part in the trial was over. I had a date to see Jesse that night, and it had kept me going with anticipation through most of the day. We met at an Embassy Suites motel in Arlington. Jesse arrived at the room after I did. She looked absolutely alluring and sexy in a low-cut black tunic. She had on black seamed stockings and high-heeled pumps. She wore red lipstick and a scarlet blush. A silver comb was set in her hair. Be still, my heart. I had a power lunch, she said by way of explanation. She kicked off her high heels. Do I make the social register or not? Well, you're definitely having a positive effect on my social register. I'll just be a minute, Alex. 1 minute. Jessie disappeared into the bathroom. She peeked out of the bathroom after a few minutes. I was on the bed. The tension in my body was draining into the mattress. Let's take a bath, Jessie said. I got up and went into the bathroom. The tub was square and unusually large. There was a lot of gleaming white and blue tile, all mounted a foot or so higher than the rest of the bathroom. Jessie's fancy clothes were strewn on the floor. You in a hurry? I asked her. Yep. Jessie had filled the tub to the brim. A few independent-minded soap bubbles floated up and popped against the ceiling. Wisps of steam rose steadily. The room smelt like a country garden. She stirred the bathwater with her fingertips. Then she came over to me. She still had the silver comb in her hair. I think it might be time for a little healing. You went for it. Jessie's hands played with the buttons on my trousers, then the zipper. Our mouths came together, lightly at first, then hard. Suddenly, Jessie took me inside her as we stood beside the steamy tub. Just two or three quick strokes, then she moved away from me again. She took my hand and pulled me into the tub. The water was warm, just right. So was everything else. We started to laugh. I still had my underwear on, but Pete was poking and peeking around. I pulled off the shorts. We maneuvered in the tub until we were facing each other. Jessie got on top of me somehow. We were unwilling to give up any contact. Jessie leaned way back. She braced her hands behind her head. She watched my face with curious fascination. Her long legs suddenly lifted straight out of the water and hooked around my head. Jessie jerked forward a couple of times, then both of us exploded. Her body went stiff. We thrashed and moaned a lot. Waves of water splashed from the tub. Somehow Jessie got her arms around me, her arms and her legs. I settled back in water just under my nose. Then I went under. Jessie was on top of me. The feeling of being close to climax rushed through my body. We were both coming. I was also going to drown. I heard Jessie yell again, a strange water-muffled sound above the surface. I climaxed as I was about to run out of air. I swallowed water and coughed. Jessie rescued me. She pulled me up and took my face in both her hands. We stayed there holding each other. Spent, as they used to say in gentler times. There was more water on the floor than in the bathtub. All I knew right then was that I was falling deeper and deeper in love. That much I was sure about. The rest of my life was mystery and chaos, but at least there was a lifeline. There was Jessie. Around 1 o'clock in the morning, I had to leave to go home. That way, I would be there when the kids got up. Jessie understood. After the trial, we were going to sort everything out a lot better. Jessie wanted to get to know Janny and Damon. It had to be done just right, we agreed. I miss you already, she said as I got ready to go. She took the silver comb out of her hair and pressed it into my hand. I went out into the night, with her voice still in my head. At first, there was nothing but the pitch darkness of the parking lot. Suddenly, two men stepped out in front of me. I automatically reached for my shoulder holster. One of them switched on a glaring light. The other had a camera aimed at my face. The press had found me and Jessie. Oh, shit. The kidnapping was so big that everything around it was a story. A young woman trailed along behind the two men. She had long, frizzy black hair. Detective Alex Cross? One of the men asked. Meanwhile, his partner took several rapid shots with the camera. The flashes lit up the dark parking lot. We're from the National Star. We want to talk to you, Detective Cross. I picked up a British accent. The National Star was an American tabloid based in Miami. What does this have to do with anything that's happened? I said to the Brit. This is private. This isn't news. This isn't anybody else's business. That's our job to decide, he said. I don't know, though, mate. Major communications breakthrough between D.C. police and the Secret Service,
secret talks and whatever. The woman was already knocking at the motel door. "This is a national star," she announced. "Don't come out," I shouted to Jessie. The door opened and Jessie stood there, fully dressed. She stared at the frizzy-haired woman and didn't bother to conceal her contempt. "This must be a really proud moment," she said to the reporter. "This is probably as close as you'll ever get to a Pulitzer." "Nah," the reporter had a comeback. "I know Roxanne Pulitzer, and now I know you too." I played a medley of Keith Sweat, Bell Biv DeVoe, Hammer, and Public Enemy songs on the piano. I stayed out on the porch entertaining Damon and Janelle until about 8 that morning. It was Wednesday of the week Jessie and I had gotten our little lured surprise in Arlington. Nana was in the kitchen reading a hot copy of the National Star, which I'd bought for her at Acme. I called Jessie a few times that morning, but she wasn't home, or she wasn't answering her phone. I thought about driving over to her apartment, but I changed my mind. We didn't need any more tabloid photographs or news stories while the trial was winding down. Nobody said much to me at work that day. If I'd had any doubts before, that showed me how serious the damage was. I'd taken a hit, all right. I went to my office and sat there all alone with a container of black coffee and stared at the four walls. They were covered with clues from the kidnapping. I was starting to feel guilty and rebellious and angry. I was at my government-issue gunmetal desk, facing away from the door. I had been staring at my work schedule for the week, but I wasn't really seeing anything written on the sheet. "You're in this one all alone, motherfucker," I heard Samson say at my back. "You're all by your lonesome this time. You are meat cooked on a barbecue spit." "Don't you think you're understating things a little?" I said without turning to him. "I figured you'd talk when you wanted to talk about it," Samson said. "You knew that I knew about the two of you." I turned around and faced him. "What do you figure is going on now?" I asked him. "What are they saying?" "Nobody's real happy about the way the holy shit kidnapping case has gone down. Not enough attaboys coming down from upstairs. I guess they're lining up potential sacrificial lambs. You're one of them for sure."
"And Jessie?" I asked.
"She's one too. Associating with known Negroes," Samson said. "I take it you haven't heard the news."
"Heard what news?"
Samson let out a short burst of breath. "She took a leave of absence, or maybe she left the service altogether. Happened about an hour ago, Alex. Nobody knows for sure if she jumped or was pushed."
I called Jessie's office immediately. The secretary said that she was gone for the day. I called Jessie's apartment. No answer there. I drove to her apartment. Nobody was home.
The verdict in the Sanigi/Murphy trial was coming down soon. The jury went out on the 11th of November. They returned after 3 days. The whole world seemed to be waiting. Samson picked me up that morning, and we rode to the courthouse together. As we approached Indiana Avenue, I thought about Jessie. I hadn't seen her in over a week. I wondered if she would show up in court for the verdict. She'd called me. She told me she was down in North Carolina. That was all she'd really said. I was a loner again, and I didn't like it. We went up the steep stone steps and into the federal courthouse. As Samson and I entered the cavernous federal courthouse lobby, the noise level might have done real damage to our eardrums. Everyone was pushing and milling about, but in a sort of civilized manner, the way folks in evening wear push into your back at the Kennedy Center. Sanigi/Murphy wasn't the first criminal trial where multiple personality was the center of the defense. It was by far the most celebrated case, though. Gary was escorted into the packed, noisy courtroom. He looked his usual clean-cut, characteristically boyish self in a plain blue suit. The jury filed into the courtroom. The men and women looked dazed and unbearably tense.
"Has the jury reached a verdict?" Judge Kaplan asked once they were seated.
A small, folded slip of paper was passed to the judge. Judge Kaplan's face was expressionless as she read the verdict. Then it went back to the jury foreman. The foreman, who had remained standing, began to speak in a clear but shaky voice.
"On 2 charges of kidnapping, we find the defendant guilty. On the charge of the murder of Michael Goldberg, we find the defendant guilty."
Chaos broke out all over the courtroom. Reporters raced for the telephones in the hallway. Mary Warner was emotionally congratulated by all the young associates on her staff.
Anthony Nathan and his defense team quickly left the room, avoiding questions. There was a strangely poignant moment in the front of the courtroom. As court officers were leading Gary away, his wife Missy and his little girl Ronnie ran up to him. The three of them fiercely hugged. They sobbed openly. I had never seen Gary cry before. If it was a performance, it was another brilliant one.